Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello everyone, welcome to Living History and a very special episode. This week has marked the 80th anniversary of the Midget submarine attack on Sydney Harbour in 1942, which was a pretty important chapter of Australia's military history. One of those funny ones, I think, that people seem to think they know a lot about, but then are quite surprised when they hear the facts and the details of the whole thing. And so to commemorate this week, which is the 80th anniversary, I wanted to do something a little bit different. We wanted to talk about what artifacts are surviving from that Midget submarine attack and how the story can be told through the items that we still have that are left over from that night in May and June 1942. So joining us to do that is a senior curator from the Australian War Memorial. It's Shane Casey. Shane, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Matt. Very excited to be talking about these things.
I should mention we had you on the podcast a couple of years ago when we did a really fascinating walk around the objects that are in storage that the War Memorial has on hand but not on display. So if you're listening to this and you want a really fascinating insight into some of the things in the War Memorial collection, go back and listen to that one because it was fantastic to walk around with you, Shane. I mean, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do? I mean, a curator at the War Memorial, I think lots of people listening to this would think that's absolutely their dream job. So, what's a day in the life of Shane Casey?
Well, Matt, sometimes it can be quite exciting. We've been able to do some tours with the ADF to current conflict zones, so in the Middle East, and went to do an operation Render Safe in Bougainville with them, and So a little bit of travel, but not very often. And obviously, over the past few years, that's been very much curtailed. But essentially, a curator is someone who cares for objects in the collection. And we try to recover material from either current conflicts or material that people have in their attics and or have brought back from operations. We try to find out the stories of them, and essentially, we try to preserve them for the good of the public. The Australian War Memorial has been around for about 100 years, and we have a really rich collection of material collected from all over the place. And often it's large things like Lancaster bomber, let's say, very iconic objects. But sometimes it's things like that you have, for example, in your, you know, the top drawer of your desk that Dad had and brought back and treasured, or your mum if she was a WAF in England during the war, some small memento that she might have had. Photographs, recordings, we've got audio recordings, and we have quite a large collection of people here who specialise in things like artworks or photographs, let's say, in the particular medium. But my colleagues and I like to try to specialise in objects, artefacts, so whether it be weapons, rifles, submachine guns, etc., or something as large as a midget submarine. But we have a really good collection, and it's amazing sometimes when we go into the database and just pick a topic, any topic, whether it be, say, well, anything really. I'm sure we've got probably about 10 or 15 of them, and these can be toys, lingerie, you name it, anything. So it's great. It's never dull, I think, and often things have been in our collection for, say, 100 years, and it's only when you look at it either in a under bright lights, or perhaps some new documents have come to light, and we find out much more about those objects and the richness of them. And Matt, if you and I were looking at say Midget submarine today, you'd probably notice things that none of us have ever noticed. You know, it's like that. It's the value of having a museum collection as opposed to just a virtual one.
Well, that's that collective knowledge, isn't it? I see that all the time when, when we're walking a battlefield, for example, on a battlefield tour, and people, I could have been to a battlefield a dozen times or two dozen times, and people still point out things that I hadn't realized. Yeah. Just from being there. It's just the value of observation. I think that's why museums are so special and so important. It sounds like a pretty impressive collection, but am I right in assuming that it gets bigger and bigger every year, that you're still adding things to the collection all the time?
Oh, absolutely. And at the moment, there's a real focus on the current conflict displays. So we've recently taken, for example, an FA-18 Hornet, which is your big thing, and some of my colleagues who are working on the displays for the Afghanistan and Iraq galleries are very, very active, meeting people every day, and often people are surprised that we're interested, that their little bit of history, their little bit of experience is regarded by us as an important thing. But it is, you know. And I think it was just late last year also, someone in the Canberra region, or YAS, said, look, I've got this old uniform in the attic. Would you be interested? Turned out to be a Sudanese uniform, so 1880s, and absolutely unique, perfect condition. It was a bit grubby, but that actually made it look really real. And but do you want this? It's just an old white uniform that's been hanging around, you know? Well, our eyes nearly dropped out of our heads when we saw it. So yes, there's more material. And with the Midget submarine attack, which, you know, is obviously the focus of our discussion today, it's surprising. 80 years ago, but there's still material coming through all the time. And in fact, Matt, you and I were having a chat about some friend of yours who has some sort of navigational equipment from that. And, you know, we've never seen that, and I don't know what it is, but it'd be fascinating to see.
Yeah, we'll see if we can convince him to at least give you a look at it. I don't know whether he'd be interested in donating it, but he might be interested in at least letting you have a look at it to see what's
out there. Well, you know, it's a funny thing. We like to know that it's out there, that it's being preserved. I think it's important that there is material out in the public domain as well. That my family has material that my father captured, and at the moment it's still precious to me because my father's passed, and it's a family connection, and my kids are interested in keeping that within. And I think it's important to have that throughout the Australian domain as well, and that it's represented in other museum collections as well.
I think you're right. That family connection is what makes it special as well. There's been a number of times when I've been leading people around the battlefields on a tour, and perhaps at the end of the tour they might say, "Oh, I've got this, which was a coin that my grandfather brought back from the Western Front, you know, after he picked this up in France and he carried it with him and he brought it back." And they go, "I'd like you to have it just as a token of appreciation." Yeah. It doesn't mean the same to me as it means to them. It's a fascinating artifact in its own right, but it's that family connection that makes it so significant. So I think you're right. I think it's great that, and it should remain that, in households across Australia, there is the old, the old bayonet that Uncle Bruce brought back from the war, or the letters that he wrote home. I think that's great stuff. I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk today about midget submarines. I think this week there's been a lot of coverage about it. I've been doing a lot of interviews about the attack and the history of it. Just so that we have a foundation, we understand what we're talking about. Could you give us a very brief overview of the attack and its significance? And then what I want to do is dig into some of those exciting artifacts you've got in the collection to help tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So, cast your mind back to 1942. Japan's on the ascendancy. It's conquered virtually all of the Pacific. It's encroaching on New Guinea. It's taken Timor. And everyone's very worried. Australia's been bombed, Darwin and Broome and the like. And Singapore has fallen. You know, huge loss of life and many, many Australians captured and now prisoners. And everywhere they were unbeatable. And so then all of a sudden, out of the blue, what do you have? You have an attack on our most populous city. So five large submarines, and we're talking really large, sort of 100-meter length with crews of about 150 people, five of these coming down, positioning themselves off Sydney, and three of those five submarines had what we call midget submarines shackled onto their upper decks. And midget submarine You know, you conjure up a thing small, sort of the size of a room, but actually they're really large for midgets. These are about 26 meters in length, you know, 80 feet or so, long and deadly looking. They look like bullets, really, black. And three of these midget submarines then made quite a perilous voyage from outside Sydney Harbour and tried to breach then the defences of Sydney Harbour and come in and sink Allied shipping. Now, they knew what shipping was there because the other two submarines that were also outside Sydney had hangars built onto their upper decks. And the inside the hangars was a Glenn float plane, which was a monoplane, and it could be assembled really quickly. A small crane would put it into the water and it would take off, or it could take off the deck. And these did reconnaissance missions over Sydney and spotted the aircraft. And at the time, Sydney siders, you know, there were a number of reports of these things being seen, but people thought they were American float planes, a Curtiss float plane. And so there was quite a bit of confusion because the Americans were around. The Americans had a large, a heavy cruiser in the harbor, Chicago. And you know, it must have been Americans just everywhere in Sydney taking in the sights and meeting the locals. And so it raised hackles, but it didn't really engender the response that it should have required. Anyway, on the night of the 31st of May, the first of these midget submarines tried to come in through the harbour, and unfortunately for it, it got caught up on the anti-submarine net. Now there was a net. Basically, the net was between North Head and Middle Head, and it was big chains. About 300 to 400 millimeters in diameter, and almost like armor mesh, if you like. But this net hadn't been completed. There were still gaps in the north and the south portion of it. And this particular submarine, what we call the HA-14, came in, seems to have sort of reversed and then wedged itself on the northern end of this submarine net. And then in the process of doing that, it sort of raised itself up out of the water and was spotted then by locals. And a man called Cargill kind of rowed out and he was on watch and he saw this thing, wasn't quite sure what it was. You know, I don't know whether it was on its side or up and down and threshing around a bit. And he banged against the side of it, you know, and anyway, he convinced himself that it was actually a submarine. He then went and notified the authorities, and there's this whole sort of time lapse lag thing going on in Sydney, and people not quite believing that it's a submarine. And anyway, the long and the short of it is, after about 2 hours, the crew of the submarine, and you can imagine it must have been desperate for them, trying as hard as they could to get out and not going anywhere. And you know, these were completely electric, so battery operated craft, and who knows what was leaking inside, and the fumes and the darkness and confusion, and it must have been awful for the crew. Well, there were two demolition charges inside each of these submarines, and they attempted to blow both of them, but they only blew one. And that one single charge blew basically the front of the conning tower area and control compartment completely open, killed the two crewmen, and the noise, of course, you know, rocked Sydney, and you know, windows were sort of shaking, and I don't know whether any were broken, but it was definite that there was something going on there in Sydney. And you'd think that would have alerted the authorities really to, you know, maximum effort, but no. Then another submarine made its attempt, and so there was a Sydney harbour anti-submarine net, but there were also listening loops. And these listening loops were placed at various distances outside the harbour, and they were basically trying to pick up the magnetic anomaly of the hull of any craft that came through. But a lot of them weren't working properly, and those that were working were hard to interpret. Lots of civilian craft were coming and going, ferries, for example, And it was almost a case of, the old parable of the boy who cried wolf. And that's sort of what happened there. So the second one came through and it, very near where the HAR-14 was destroyed, and it was seen, submerged, and harbour defence craft came, and by this stage they were on full alert, and they depth charged all around it, and for a couple of hours, and basically then nothing happened. They thought they'd destroyed the craft, and this is kind of an important part of the story in that. For a long time, for many days afterwards, they thought that there were actually four midget submarines in the harbour because of this event. Anyway, this particular submarine, though, the HAR-21, just went doggo, on the bottom for a couple of hours. And then eventually, and again, we don't know what's happening inside this submarine. Is one of the crewmen dead already? Are they both injured? Are they concussed? They eventually managed to get their craft up and running, and I'm turning to my right here because I've got a couple of maps on the side that plot the progress. They then did a big circuit in and went past sort of Macquarie's chair, did a big loop. They were spotted then, and they ended up in Taylor's Bay, and they were the last craft to be really attacked. That was then the following morning they were depth charged, and they ended up on the bottom at Taylor's Bay, and the crew then shot themselves. And meanwhile, you've got another one then following after. So these three submarines aren't coming in all at the same time. They're sort of staggering it. And there's a lot of speculation as to what would have happened if they had come in together. Would they have overwhelmed the defences? Or, if the mother submarines had not gone sort of north up to a rendezvous, if they'd stuck around at the harbour entrance and tried to pick off ships as they came in, would the story have been different? But anyway, getting back to the third submarine, this is the what we call the M24. This is the one that had the greatest success. So it came in and operated. It was coming towards Garden Island. So this is the eastern side of Garden Island, and the big ship, the Chicago, is berthed there at Garden Island, and as well as a number of other ships. And the M24 sees it, fires, misses, and one of its torpedoes then goes underneath a Dutch submarine, the K-19, which is berthed nearby, and explodes just to the side of the cutter bow. And a cutter bow is lifted up, and immediately settles. And of course, probably the concussion and explosive effects of the blast probably killed most of the sailors on board the Cutterball, but those that survived that would have been drowned then. So they were the Allied casualties, 21 naval personnel, 19 Australians and 2 Brits. And the Cutterball was an accommodation ferry. Oh, it was an old ferry that was being used as an accommodation ship. Barn, the captain of that submarine, fired another round, another torpedo, and it also missed, but it ran aground at Garden Island, and it just sort of beached itself. And there are photographs in the Australian War Memorial Collection of it beached and sort of still dangerous. He then sort of does a big loop, and it's really difficult to work out exactly what he did and where he went. The accounts are quite confused. The Chicago knows that there's a Japanese submarine, has seen it. The Canberra, HMAS Canberra, is also in port. It thinks it sees something. It's firing. There are other ships firing. Loads of rounds going off all over the place. Flares, the explosion from the Cutterball has taken the lights out in Garden Island. So the whole thing, Garden Island was lit up. But then they doused the lights just before the attack on the Cutterball. But then all of the communications and all the electrics go out for a short time. So a bit of confusion there. And that particular submarine, though, manages to slip out of the harbour and disappear. And it was only found then in 2006 off the northern Sydney beaches. And the New South Wales Department of the Environment they've got some great maritime archaeologists and historians working for them, a great bunch of people, And they've done some fantastic work on diving on that and trying to work out what happened to it. And it's really interesting that this, again, is the value of an artifact. That submarine sitting on the surface, on the bottom of the ocean, there's a ladder that goes up into the conning tower. And this ladder is a folding ladder. You know, it would come down and you'd fold it down, climb up and get out of the conning tower. Well, the conning tower has been corroded so badly that you can actually see this ladder in position, and it's still in the folded position. So the New South Wales Department of the Environment archaeologists speculate that the crewmen are still on board that submarine, that they never got out. And again, it's quite a long distance, you know, that they had to travel. So there they are. They've been released from the mother submarine. They go through quite heavy seas. They get in. They, you know, they're all geared up and everything, and they do this big attack. They probably think they've sunk the Chicago. You know, who knows what they thought. They've definitely loosed off their two torpedoes, and that's it. And they're now going for the rendezvous. They're tired. They're probably groggy from the fumes, from the lack of oxygen, from just being seasick. You know, who knows what horrors they had endured, really. And then finally, there they are on the bottom. They didn't detonate their self-explosive charges. They might have just passed out and died.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, getting back to the war memorial then, and what happened to the craft, we know then that there's one craft that's still stuck in the torpedo net, and we know that there's one craft now that's been depth charged and is in Taylor's Bay, and we've got oil and bubbles and debris floating to the surface, and you know we're pretty sure that it's done. So the Maritime Services Board have this massive floating pontoon with a shear legs on it. It's called the Maritime Services Board steam shear legs, and it appears in lots of the photographs. It's actually quite a really interesting thing in its own right, you know, because if you're interested in Sydney Harbour, it appears all through the 1920s and 30s, 40s and 50s, you know, until it was sort of pulled apart. I'm digressing a bit there, but this thing is used then to they send divers down. The divers on the HAR 21, the depth charged one, find that the motors are still running and the props are still running. You know, everything's still going. They work out that there's still torpedoes in there, and so you know everything's pretty dangerous. And they basically, over the course of the next 2 or 3 days, manage to kind of move the wreck of the torpedo closer and closer to the shore using a combination of this steam derrick and shackles, and it's a really dicey thing. And then when they finally pull it up, it's again very dicey, because what they don't want is these torpedoes falling out, you know, and exploding. So the divers who worked on that, absolutely super super brave and horrible nasty conditions, you know. And then a few days after they've recovered that and put it onto the pontoon, they take it to Shark Island, and it's resting there. And then they go and recover the HAR 14, which so you've got the stern and the control tower, and it's all exploded, peeled back, but the bow section has sort of projected itself forward, and so it's about 20 meters forward, and that's recovered as well, and that's got both of its torpedoes still in place. With there are these caps on the ends of the torpedoes, torpedo tubes. So they recover that and they bring that back to Shark Island as well. And this is where then the Navy sort of says, you know, thanks very much, Maritime Services Board, you know, you can go now. And they take over and they photograph everything, you know, interior. They also recover the remains of the crew members, and the coroner does, you know, an autopsy and everything on that, on those. And the Navy then says, well, you know, look, these Muirhead Gould, who's the commander of forces, naval forces in Sydney Harbour, makes a statement, which I've actually got here, if I may read out.
Please do.
He gives them a military funeral, you know, and there's a lot of criticism. Hang, you know, these are the enemy. Why should we be doing that? And he says, Muirhead Gould said, I've been criticised for having accorded these men military honours, as we hope may be accorded to our own comrades who have died in enemy lands. But I ask you, should we not accord full honours to such brave men as these? It must take courage of the very highest order to go out in a thing like that steel coffin. I hope I shall not be a coward when my time comes, but I confess that I wonder whether I should have the courage to take one of those things across Sydney Harbour in peacetime. Theirs was a courage which is not the property or the tradition or the heritage of any one nation. It is the courage shared by the brave men of our own countries as well as the enemy. And however horrible war and its results may be, it is a courage which is recognized and universally admired. These men were patriots of the highest order. How many of us are really prepared to make 1,000th of the sacrifice these men made? So, you know, that's coming from the leader of the naval forces here in Australia, and it's really quite a powerful statement. And he copped a lot of flack from that. But the crew members, the four crew members, were then their bodies were cremated, and we were then repatriating diplomatic staff back to Japan, and diplomatic staff was coming our way, and the ashes were repatriated as well. And it was sort of, the Australian authorities were thinking that this was a good thing to do because, you know, so many Australians have been captured. If we show, you know, we're fairly decent people and we respect them, maybe they'll be good to our people. And it's interesting. Apparently, the way it was recorded in Japan was not the way we had anticipated. You know, it was basically the thought in Japan was, well, yeah, of course they've returned our ashes. You know, why wouldn't they return our brave ashes? No other country has people like ours. You know, these are sort of gods almost. So it kind of, it didn't backfire on us, but it didn't have the results that we wanted.
It seems now, that throughout the war there was that vain hope that if we treated the Japanese in our hands well, they would reciprocate. And time again, I've just finished writing a book about the Kara breakout, which right. is probably the best example of how the hope that if we treated the Japanese well, they would do the same for our prisoners did not play out at all during the war.
No. However, one good thing about having this midget submarine wreck here and preserved is that it has actually served as a bit of a symbol of reconciliation between Japan and Australia. In the late 1960s, the mother of one of the crewmen came out here, and you know, with the full diplomatic entourage, and she poured some sake into the wreck of the craft, and gave some mementos, and you know, and it was reciprocated. And it, I think, by then, even, you know, late 1960s, it was pretty raw still, but that was one of the first real signs of sort of friendship, I think, on a really tangible level.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us about the submarine that is in the collection of the War Memorial, because this is obviously, if we talk artifacts, there's no artifact more important than the actual submarine itself. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? It's not a complete midget submarine. Tell us the story.
No. So the two submarines were recovered onto Shark Island and examined very closely, and the Allies were dead keen on knowing, you know, what improvements had the Japanese made to these. Are there any secrets to this? And so you had, for example, the batteries of one of them taken out, and they went to a local Sydney battery manufacturing company. And there's a really good report in the National Archives of Australia by that company where they say, you know, this is really good and it's highest quality, and I wish we could make batteries like this and that sort of thing. And, you know, full marks to them. all of the gyroscopes were studied, and the propulsion system, the air filtration system, you name it, the welding, it was examined. And they found, for example, that when the blast occurred in the Ha-14, that even though it had peeled everything out and you know, you've got shattered plates, none of the welds had broken. And this was commented on as an example of, wow, you know, they're actually pretty good. The torpedoes as well were very, very closely examined, and all the serial numbers of the torpedoes recorded and what happened to them, and that's there as well. And luckily, much of this material has been digitized in recent years, and so we've been able to go to our artifact and see the photographs and compare then and now. And now, what happened though with those submarines is you really couldn't assemble a complete submarine from one because of the destruction and whatnot. And so they ended up, the Navy, pretty much making a composite of two of the submarines. So we've got the bow section of the one that was sunk in Taylor's Bay, and we've got the control compartment and the rear of the one that was that blew itself up on the submarine net. And these components were put on trailers and towed around Australia or the eastern seaboard and parts of South Australia. And they went on public display, big signs on them, you know, saying, you know, Japanese submarine, et cetera, et cetera, raising money for the war effort and for sailors' benefits, you know. And so really, although the Japanese had intended this as a great sort of, you know, morale defeating aspect, I suppose, it actually had the reverse effect. You know, it was almost a, hey, this is what we can do if they attack us. And you know, for many people, this would have been their first exposure to anything Japanese. It must have been. And there are great photographs in our collection of people writing their names on the side in chalk. You know, Muriel is one that sticks in my mind, you know, just Muriel having written her name in big white chalk. And and people also then, there were these weights, lead weights, and we've still got about, oh, maybe about 80 of them. They're about the size of a brick, I guess. And but the Navy actually managed to melt a bunch of those down, and here we go. I don't know whether you can see this. I'm holding my hands for the benefit of the people listening to this. It's a lead model of a submarine, a Japanese midget submarine, and it's about 100 millimeters long and about 15 millimeters high, and it's got on the side of it, sunk in Sydney Harbour, May 31st, 1942, on one side, and then on the other side, which was the side I was pointing towards you then, Matt, made from ballast, Jap midget sub. And these things were produced in their hundreds and hundreds, and you could buy them and own your own little bit of Japanese, you know, midget submarine. And of course, the proceeds all went to the war effort. So it was really quite a good, fantastic thing.
You showed me that diagram you had before we started talking. Why don't you hold that up?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I'll post a copy of it on the show notes for people that don't have the visual version.
It's a bit hokey, you know. It's just it's not to scale necessarily, Matt. But basically, it shows the am I on screen there?
Yeah, that's
it shows
fine. That's good.
The three submarines. So there's one that is complete and is still on the seabed off the northern shore. That's the one that actually sunk the Cutterball. Then there's one that is largely now not extant, but the middle part of it is owned by the Royal Australian Navy. And that one, what they did with that is they stripped the casing off it to reveal the access hatch in a workings. And so that's actually on display at Spectacle Island, I think it is, up in Sydney. And there's just a little part of it. So it's that bit there between my fingers. And then the rest of it is the stern and the middle part of the submarine that's now with the Australian War Memorial. I should say, the Ha-21, the one that was sunk in Taylor's Bay, the bow section of that is the one that we've also got. So if you can imagine, we've got the stern, the middle bit, and then we've got the front bit, the bow bit of the other one. And then the torpedoes are kind of interesting. I was saying that there's this record at the National Archives, Australian National Archives, which I can't remember what it's called, something like Technical Aspects of the Midget Submarine. It's available online for anyone to have a look at. Great reading. And it goes into, you know, the minutiae of the batteries and stuff like that. But it also talks about the torpedoes. And there was this was a period when Japanese torpedo technology, or shall I put that down? Is that right?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. As I said, we'll put that up on. We'll put that in the show. We'll put a link to that. I'll get a photo of that after the interview.
No worries.
We'll put it up so people can
get you a copy of it. The Japanese torpedo technology was pretty good. You know, they had taken a lot of lessons from the Brits and the Germans, and had perfected their own highly effective torpedo types. And the particular ones that are in the Midget submarines were you know, especially geared towards being fitted into their own midget submarines rather than regular sized submarines. So what we've got then is after everything went on display, it came back to the Australian War Memorial then, and it was placed. The composite submarine was placed on display outside the memorial until the early 2000s, and then it was conserved. You know, we've got professional conservators here who fantastic their job and, you know, do all sorts of creative things with making things last for hundreds of years. And it was put on display then in our Anzac Hall. In the last year and a half or so, we've taken it off display, and because we're building a new building there that'll be a bit better able to display it. And it's now those midget submarine parts are in a storage area. And but we're working on a new display for them that is really going to be hopefully, you know, much more easily able to be understood. You know, people like myself who aren't Sydneysiders have difficulty knowing where Taylor's Bay and everything is, and the track of the submarines as they entered is really quite confusing because they're coming in at different times, and that one that was depth charged is kind of hanging around, you know, it's sort of doing its thing and then it's waiting and then it's coming again. So you've got this really confused chronology, and you know, if you know, if the listeners go onto the NAA website and look at all the Japanese midget submarine stuff, it's really, even in the day back in 1942 when the Navy was trying to work out exactly what happened, it's clear that they only ever got about 80% of the story right, you know, and we still only know about 80% of the story. In the recent a couple of months or so, we've been looking very closely though at the parts that we have, and you know, shining lights on parts that haven't had a light shine on them for years and years and years. And we're very fortunate here at the memorial to have a fantastic Japanese translator who is really well versed in the old Japanese scripts and things, and because he's been working with us for a number of years, he gets military technology in a way that probably most modern Japanese wouldn't, you know. He's well versed in sort of 1940s technology, and so we took Haruki and inside the conning tower of the submarine and had him translate things, and it was interesting because we also found lots of equipment inside the submarine that were obviously manufactured in either in a Western country. You know, they had things like port and starboard, and it's clear that the Japanese had bought off the shelf valves and things like that. You know, at the end of the day, though, what we've got though in the collection is a device or it's a weapon of war. It's a weapon that killed 21 Australians, or, you know, 19 Australians and two Brits. And we, you know, we've got to always remember that. And also the one that we've got is one that two men committed suicide in. So it's a very visceral object. And the area where the blast occurred is, you know, it is a very visceral thing. You know, it was a big, big explosive charge. You know, I don't know how big, it might have been 30, 40 kilograms or so. And so it's, you know, it's quite a moving thing when you look at it that way. And then, you know, when you remember those comments that I was reading out to you from Muirhead Gould, about, you know, his admiration and his appreciation of just how nasty and horrible it was. We the West, the Western Allies had their own midget submarines, as you know, the X craft that attacked the Tirpitz and Sydney Singapore Harbour, not Sydney Harbour, and we're lucky in that lots of those men survived and were interviewed. Here in Australia, we had one guy, Kenneth Hudspeth, won the DSC three times in midget submarines. And I think it was him. He was saying on one particular episode, they were cooped into this sarcophagus for so long, and that when they opened the hatch and got fresh air after, you know, 24 hours, let's say, of being under, that their reaction was to vomit. You know, and feel just horribly nauseous at the fresh air coming in, you know, and the condensation just dripping over everything, you know, constantly having to kind of clean things, you know, and it was just horrible, you know. It's the smell of stale odor and everything, and battery acid, and must have been
just awful. Extraordinary. It's extraordinary stuff. Yeah. I know you've got the submarine, you've got the torpedoes, you've got other smaller bits and pieces. I wanted to ask you, Shane, what's the point of all this? We can read history books, we can read first-hand accounts. Why does it enhance our understanding to actually have objects left over from this event?
Yeah. I think you know, it is, as you say, one thing to just read about it, but another to actually see the effects of that blast and to speculate on what that did to a human body, you know. And you know, you can, again, it is one thing to read in very bland terms about, you know, the five mother submarines and the midget, but to see just how cramped it is, and to know also, to look at those levers and think, you know, there was a human hand pulling that, and everything's, you know, someone was actually in that. And you often find, I think, here at the War Memorial that people who have a connection with something feel the need to touch it, and somehow there's something about touch that you don't get from a picture. And size also. You know, I mentioned earlier that it's not really a midget. You know, it's a large submarine. And some people are just gobsmacked by how large these things are. And the difficulty then of, you know, and imagining then, you know, if you are, say, from Sydney and, let's say, you know, North Shore, let's say, and, you know, used to glancing at the harbour, to then come to the War Memorial and see that midget submarine and think, wow, that was actually in the waters off my, you know, hometown. I think it's, you get something from an artifact that you just don't get. We recently were given a telephone handset from one of the midget submarines, and you'd have to think, you know, come on, you know, what's it, who are they phoning? and a few of my colleagues sort of, you know, laughed at that. But again, the National Archive documents have photographs, one of which has a picture of this handset in it. And it's clear that when this thing was shackled onto the deck, the upper deck of its mother submarine, and the crew were inside, they were able to presumably pick up the phone and dial into the mother submarine and communicate and sort of, you know, we're ready to go now, release the shackles or something like that, you know. And this telephone handset, it's large. It's about probably about 300 millimeters long, and it's one of those old-fashioned, almost like, you know, the old-fashioned one that you would ring. And in fact, it probably did have some sort of magneto type of thing, dynamo. But this has got leather on its on the part where you hold it, and it's Bakelite earpiece and Bakelite mouthpiece, and you know, I held it up and I thought, wow, you know, well, not the last person who's held this, but, you know, there was a real connection there with the person who had once used this in the submarine. You know, you just don't get that from the picture, I think.
I agree entirely. It's the same when you visit, you know, when you walk a battlefield and see an old German pillbox, or go to the cemeteries and see the headstones and the graves of the the people that died. I agree. It's that human connection. And I recall being a kid going to the War Memorial when the submarine was still outside and, you know, we didn't exactly scramble over it. We couldn't do that, but you could touch it. You could go up to it. And as much as I understand the need for preservation and context, I do in some ways miss the days when you used to be able to run your hands all over these artifacts and feel that that human connection. It's a really important thing. It's the reason we have museums and the reason why museums will always be important. I'm going to post photographs of these artifacts on the page as well, Shane, so that people can see what we're talking about. And next time I'm down there, we'll absolutely do a follow-up where we'll go around and see some of these items firsthand, because it's one of the things I really enjoy about exploring the War Memorial. But it's just been really fascinating. Thank you for adding this wonderful dimension to this well-known story. It's really wonderful work you're doing there at the War Memorial, and thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, well, thank you, Matt. It's great to be able to share that story, I'd really like to say thank you to anyone who's listening who has photographs or artifacts who considers these things and preserves them either for yourself and your own family or for the nation.
Thanks, Shane. Great to have you on the show.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.